who entereth herein, a conqueror
yes.
hath
yeah.
been.
All right,
who slayeth the dragon,
right,
the shield,
bright
helmet,
bright blonde hair.
You have to talk him.
He never had a job, no other family anyone could ever find.
This is the Disappearance Podcast, Episode 2, The Mad Tryst.
Who entereth herein, a conqueror hath been, who slayeth the dragon, the shield he shall win.
That quote, as read by my wife Carol, was written on an index card and taped to the side of a cardboard box I inherited from someone I briefly and barely knew in high school, a kid named Alistair Glamis. He disappeared a year after we graduated, almost two decades ago. There is one thing about this whole mystery that is no longer a mystery. It's that dragon quote. 2 days after I posted the first episode of this audio project, I received a message from someone who knew the source of the quote. Can you repeat what you told me in the message?
Sure. That quote is from The Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe.
I'm speaking to Kelsey, who messaged me through the Facebook page I made for this show.
I love Poe, by the way. He's the best.
Isn't that the one about the old estate with the guy going
oh,
crazy
but
inside?
There is a dragon mentioned. The narrator guy. He reads to his friend. He tries to calm him by reading something called The Mad Tryst, which doesn't exist, by the way. It's a story within a story. That's where the quote comes from.
What else can you tell me about the story?
Honestly, I didn't know it was called The Mad Tryst until I Googled it. I did remember the dragon part from high school, so I messaged you. I looked up the rest online. You should probably contact an English professor or something.
I contacted Eileen Ruddle, an associate professor of English at the University of New Hampshire. She listened to my first episode and agreed to help me make sense of the Edgar Allan Poe quote. I sat down with her in a quiet corner of the Diamond Library on campus 2 days ago.
The Fall of the House of Usher was published in 1839. Is this good?
Yeah, the mic is picking up well.
Okay, good. The story is told from the perspective of an unnamed narrator who is invited into a crumbling estate owned by his boyhood friend, Roderick Usher. Roderick Usher is suffering from a disease of the mind, classic Poe. At the climax of the story, the narrator tries to calm Roderick by reading to him. Specifically, he reads from a medieval romance called The Mad Tryst of Sir Lancelot Canning.
Is that the story right there? Can you share a bit about what The Mad Tryst is about?
Of course. It's about a drunk knight. His name is Ethelred.
Ethelred?
Yes, Ethelred. He enters a hermit's shack by force to escape the storm. But what's inside is completely bizarre.
What do you mean?
Inside, it isn't a shack at all. It's another world, a golden palace. And there's a dragon. Do you want me to actually read some of the story?
Absolutely.
The good champion Ethelred, now entering within the door, was sore enraged and amazed to perceive no signal of the maliceful hermit. But, in the stead thereof, a dragon of a scaly and prodigious demeanor, and of a fiery tongue which sate in guard before a palace of gold with floor of silver.
And where does the quote that was on the side of Alistair's box come in?
On the wall of the golden palace, there's a brass shield inscribed with your quote. Who entereth herein, a conqueror hath been. Who slayeth the dragon, the shield he shall win.
Okay, that's fun.
Fun indeed. The words inscribed on the brass shield were the exact words written on the index card taped to the side of the cardboard box that I inherited from Alistair Glamis. But why? I have no idea. There's a bit more to the story of the knight Ethelred. After speaking with Eileen, I read the rest of the story. The knight Ethelred actually kills the dragon and takes the shield, but he ends up dropping it. And that's all we know. The narrator gets distracted and he never goes back to the reading. I'm not going to ruin the fall of the House of Usher for you. Let's just say there's a dark and disturbing conclusion for the poor Usher family.
Lover, your love is like black magic. Every kiss is tragic. I'm in a spell.
During my last episode, I played a hidden recording on what it appeared to be a damaged copy of Whipped Cream and Other Delights by Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass. My friend Tom Allegost, who's been trying to make sense of the recordings, brought me more audio files he's uncovered from the record. Tom said I should sit down for this. He was right. He came over to my house and we listened to the expanded recording together. If you're driving in your car, then you might want to pull over for a moment. I'm now going to play for you Alistair's hidden message. I don't know what else to call it. Here it is.
Now, that's some creepy stuff.
That's my friend Tom. Like I said, he came over to my house to unveil the new recording.
I didn't tell you I'm also getting over a cold.
Great, great.
Each side of an LP can hold a lot of sound, depending on the speed of playback. I've only done the digital transfer for one record. It may take me a while to tackle all eight, but there could be a lot of strange audio to sift through.
Do you have any idea how or why this was done?
I don't know. I have a lot of theories. I can tell you that this was done on purpose, like some kind of sound art.
You think this was an art project?
Yeah, maybe.
So Alistair Glamis could have given Frank Zappa a run for his money?
Not exactly. Frank Zappa was an experimental musician. There's a difference between experimental music and sound art. I'm a geek for this kind of stuff.
It's still a mystery as to why he wanted me to have these records.
You guys never hung out together?
Not that I know of. It's been a long time. He was only in school for the last 3 months of senior year, and I think we only had that one physics class together.
Well, clearly you made some kind of impact. Maybe you gave him milk money or something.
After I released episode one of this program, I was surprised to get quite a few messages. It is incredible that so many people are already listening. One of the messages I received was an email from Alfred P. Daniels. He's the now-retired lawyer from Barton, New Hampshire, who was in charge of cleaning out the Glamis house after Alistair's father died last year. He originally sent me the cardboard box containing the mysterious records. Now, I guess he's one of my listeners. He revealed something that he neglected to mention when we met. Luckily, he agreed to call me for a recording session. Here's Mr. Daniels.
Alistair's father's name was Sam. If there's a mention of Sam on the record, then I suppose it could have been Sam Glamis.
Can you tell me a little bit more about him? I know very little other than he was Alistair's father and he died last year.
He kept to himself mostly. I saw him at the country store every once in a while. He walked there. I don't know what to say. He was a tall man, a tall, lanky sort of fellow. He did a lot of walking. He carried a gun.
A gun?
Need I remind you of the open carry laws in our state? I wouldn't say there was anything odd about old Sam Glamis. He was private, yes. Many folks around here are. He was perhaps a little more so. He lived off the grid.
He lived off the grid. That's interesting.
Not really. We're all a couple steps away from being off the grid in Barton. His house was a small cabin. It had solar power he rigged himself. Wood stove for heat. He must have chopped a lot of wood come winter. There was no telephone either.
How did people, know he was dead?
Sam didn't die in the house. He was in the hospital. I suppose in the end he saw the value of the grid.
Mr. Daniels went on to tell me that the 80 acres of land where Alistair Glamis lived with his father, Sam, was bought by a conservation philanthropy group who in turn donated it to a nonprofit land trust. Basically, it meant that the land will remain secluded and wooded for years to come. I asked him if I was ever in Barton if I could check out the cabin. He reminded me that that would not be possible.
The Glamis cabin is gone. Remember when I told you that they burned his stuff? After we cleaned it out, they burned the cabin too. It was part of a controlled burn by the Barton Fire Department. Nothing's left but the memories.
I've been doing a lot of thinking about Alistair's use of Poe's short story. I just feel like it is such a specific reference that there must be something to it. I haven't really found anything except for this. On October 3rd, 1849, 10 years after he published The Fall of the House of Usher, Edgar Allan Poe was found delirious outside Gunner's Hall, an Irish tavern in Baltimore. He was so out of it that he was unable to explain how he came to be there. I also found out, and you should look this up because it's really bizarre, he wasn't wearing his own clothes. And before he died, he repeatedly called out a name, Reynolds. To this day, well over 150 years later, no one knows who Reynolds may have been. In the words of my friend Tom, that is some creepy stuff.
Lover, your love is like pure danger. Your heart is the dark stranger. Asking for a ride. Oh, lover, careful with that fire. The flame is growing higher. The smoke is in my eyes. Oh,
okay. Hello, this is John Herman. I'm recording into my phone. I was jogging just now and I came up with some thoughts on the project. I want to record them fresh. I'm sure I'm going to re-record this, so... Whether or not Alistair's record collection was an art project or not, the fact of the matter is that a young man still went missing, and he was never found. I just want to do a good job with this. All these messages keep coming in and... yes, they're supportive, but I need to stay focused. It does seem like Alistair's sending me down a deliberate path, but it's probably just my imagination. I mean, it's gotta be. I know that the human brain processes things by making connections, but the danger is that a lot of times those connections can have no basis in reality. I have to make a decision about what this show is going to be. And if I'm looking for connections, then I need to make sure that these connections are real, not just a figment of my imagination or the imagination of my listeners. Okay, I think that's all I have to say right now. I think I'm going to keep jogging.
Okay, I guess I decided to keep my jogging recording as is. As I mentioned, I've been getting a lot of messages concerning the first episode,
and clearly it's on the brain. I thought about featuring a bunch of the comments and making an almost meta episode about them. Let's just say some pretty wild theories were proposed. But I really do want to stay focused and productive. So instead, I've decided to be very selective with the communications I share. With that in mind, I want to share a message that I think could be very productive. It came to me through the project's website, disappearancepodcast.com. It read simply, "Hello, my name is Jessica Morlick. We went to high school together. I can tell you about Alistair. I was his girlfriend." I will be speaking with Jessica during my next episode. In the meantime, if you know anything about how or why this was done, or you're connected with Alistair Glamis in any way and wish to share, or if you want to support the show or explore companion materials, then please visit my website at disappearancepodcast.com. Thanks to Tom Allegost, Alfred P. Daniels, Kelsey Erickson of Deathcast, Eileen Ruddle, the University of New Hampshire, and my wife Carol for making this episode possible. Thanks also to Rudy Sims and Prom Queen for providing the music. Thanks finally to Jason Robertson, Michelle Bonsack, John Briggs, Elliot Baker, and Jeremy Murphy for the support. Please take a moment to rate and review this program on iTunes so word can spread about the project. Thank you. Let's talk in 2 weeks.
Partners in Crime Media.